inspection is next.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 1993, Mogadishu. The events of that time in that place changed America's war psyche. On October 3rd and 4th, what was supposed to be an hour-long military mission in the heat of Somalia turned into a disaster. Hundreds of Somalis were killed, along with 18 American soldiers. Almost immediately, the U.S. withdrew from the desperate nation that caps the Horn of Africa. Now, after almost a decade, Somalia is back on America's radar. With concerns that the country is connected to Al-Qaeda, the U.S. war on terror may head to this country, rife with lawlessness and clan warfare, cursed by starvation and poverty. Now, some say making Somalia the next target could provide the country with the international attention it lost on that day when the U.S. soldiers left. But many more fear it will just mean more bombing in a country with little left to destroy. Connection listeners, are you concerned about the prospect of the U.S. war on terror shifting its sight to Somalia? What lessons did America learn in the streets of Mogadishu? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join the conversation. With me today, Mark Bowden, journalist and author of Black Hawk Down, the account of that of those days, October 3rd and 4th, 1993, Mogadishu. We hope later to be speaking with John Drysdale, an expert on Somalia who is in the country, and Scott Peterson, author of another book, Me Against My Brother. We're going to start, though, with the latest news from East Africa. A number of leaders are gathering in Khartoum to talk about their response to terror. Devan Maharaj is a correspondent with the LA Times. He's in Nairobi and watching the events there. Devan, tell me, is this meeting in Khartoum an important one to keep an eye on?
I mean, it's worth keeping your eye on, but very few people expect that there will be some tangible result for Somalis.
Why is that?
Because previous meetings have been futile and fruitless, and Somalis think that they will have to come up with their own solution to their problems, and that the presidents of Kenya and Ethiopia and these other East African countries are just talking, and that's what it's all about, just talk right now.
So Somalia's place at the table, it doesn't come with the same stature as the other East African nations.
That's right. Somalia now has a transitional national government, which was set up at a peace conference in Djibouti in 2000. That government controls parts of Mogadishu and has influence in some parts of Somalia, but not broad influence. A lot of the country is still run by warlords and clans, and the government itself of Abdi Qasim Salad Hassan doesn't have the same sway as some of the other presidents do.
Just a last point from you, Devan. You were in Somalia about a month ago. You had to go in with a number of bodyguards, as reporters do in that country. Did you leave with the sense that it is a place where the sort of terrorists the United States is concerned about are making plans?
I think it'd be very difficult for terrorists to make plans in the way that we've been reading in news accounts. Myself and other journalists in Nairobi have gone in, aid workers, even a U.S. official, and I think there is a consensus that it's going to be very difficult for terrorists of the Al-Qaeda group, or ILK, to set up any firm foothold right now in Somalia with the current global conditions being as they are.
Devan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Devan Maharaj is LA Times correspondent based in Nairobi. We now turn to Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, and Scott Peterson, Christian Science Monitor reporter and author of Me Against My Brother, a book based on Scott's time as a correspondent working in Africa. And Mark, first to you, because in your book, Black Hawk Down, one of the things that stands out more for me than anything else is how it was that the Americans at that time in 93 three so infuriated the moderates, the people who had welcomed them there in the first place? And I'm wondering if you see this possibly happening again.
Well, it happened in 1993 because the United States and the UN made a couple of very bloody forays into the city looking for Mohammed Farah Aidid. And I think it was a product of poor intelligence and excess of enthusiasm. And as a result, they targeted members of the clan that Mohammed Farah Aidid belonged to who might have been willing to support the UN or U.S. effort against Aidid. And it had the effect of turning the whole clan against the UN effort.
Scott Peterson, that's a classic mistake, is it not, to turn on one clan or to side with one clan in a country like that?
Well, it is a classic mistake, and certainly one that you would not want to make in Somalia, because there, this is a place where, in fact, some of the incidents that Mark is talking about that made Somalis change their minds about this operation, especially those that were kind of wavering in between, still hadn't decided yet whether they were going to be, whether they could or could not support the UN and the U.S. operation in Somalia. Some of those attacks by the United States and some of those operations to try and find Aidid actually caused all Somalis to turn against the operation. I mean, Somalis who at least couldn't believe that there would be, that the United States was able to, mete out these kind of casualties in any, in any kind of a humanitarian operation. I mean, most Somalis welcomed the Americans when they first came, but when things began to turn into a manhunt for Mohammed Farah Aidid, things changed rather quickly.
And Mark Bowden, looking again at 2002 through the lens of 1993, it seems that the American military was very clumsy at that time. Do you think there were lessons learned then?
Oh, I think so. I think part of the reason that the effort was such a clumsy one and it was so misdirected was that the UN on the ground in Mogadishu was requesting elite American forces like Delta Force and the Rangers, who specialize in doing these kind of snatch-and-grab missions. And at first, the Clinton administration denied them those forces, so they were put in the position of going out and doing these manhunts with UN forces, with conventional army units who are very good at some things, but not terribly good at what they were doing in this instance. And they also had very poor intelligence at that point. So I would hope that if the United States were to target anyone or anything in Somalia, that we would be working with the A-team at this point.
And Scott Peterson, what do you think the chances of making that turnaround are where the intelligence could be valuable, useful, and reliable coming from a place like Mogadishu, anywhere in Somalia?
Well, I don't think the chances are very high that it can be, in part because we've already seen groups of warlords and others who oppose this transitional national government, which are basically those who the United States operatives have visited already. We know that some of the warlords, including Aidid's son, in fact, have been providing lists of people who they say are terrorists in their country. But all of these people also, just as they did in 1993 and 1992, they all have their own grudges, they all have their own political and clan affiliations, and all of those things color their decisions and their choice of who are terrorists and who are not. So I think if we're going to avoid, it will be extremely difficult for us to avoid being misled or making some of the same miscalculations. And one thing, though, that I think that we should remember about what did happen in 1993 was that one of the reasons that Delta Force was there at all was because the UN, the main UN commander who was heading up the entire UN operation in Somalia at the time, was in fact an American. Admiral Jonathan Howe was a man who basically knew that Delta Force existed, knew about their capabilities, and therefore was able to apply personally to the Clinton administration. He'd formerly been on the National Security Council, and the fact that he had been formerly a ranking American official was able to, meant that he was able to more credibly ask for Delta Force and the Rangers. And certainly in terms of all the manhunt operations with Delta and the Rangers, those were those were American operations. But the thing is, exactly as Mark says, we want to avoid those kind of things, and we just need to get our intelligence better.
But there is a link, though, Mark, isn't there? Because you talk about how the soldiers in Mogadishu in 1993 had actually learned to shoot helicopters out of the sky by taking lessons from the Mujahideen who'd done the same thing to the Russians in Afghanistan. It's almost like there's a circle of war or military wisdom here.
Well, there certainly are a lot of very skilled fighters in that part of the world. These are people who've been fighting with each other for many years. And, I think the tradition of battling between clans in that country probably goes back longer than any of us can remember. So you're dealing with very experienced fighters. And I think that it was a mistake on the part of the U.S. forces to underestimate their capabilities in 1993, and it would be a mistake today.
Do you agree with that, Scott?
I think it would be. And definitely this is one of the mistakes. I think that when the Americans first arrived in 1992 in December for this humanitarian mission, and as things began to change the following spring, I think that what wasn't recognized was the danger that the Somalis themselves could play. The fact that just about every male in that city of Mogadishu is carrying a gun led to didn't undermine the threat for people until casualties started coming in. And for example, one thing I will never forget, having made quite a few visits at the time to Somalia, was the fact that so many American helicopters were flying so low, even from the first days of that operation. They just didn't seem to be concerned that there might be a danger from below. And the fact is that I felt many times I would have been able myself to have thrown a stone up to hit one of these Blackhawks or one of the Cobras. That's how low they were. Until they started to lose helicopters.
We're joined on the line now by John Drysdale, who's author of a number of books on Somalia, including his recent Stoics Without Pillows. And John Drysdale is also acknowledged as an advisor to people both in and outside the country and has been for a number of decades. Hello, John.
Yes, hello.
We're talking here about whether or not the United States should be focusing its attention on Somalia as a haven of terrorists at this point. What's your perspective?
Well, I think that Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda would be very foolish if they were thinking of going to Mogadishu. I think that in many ways it might be a good thing if they did go there, because I don't think they would last more than about 48 hours. The Somalis, when they have their differences, of course, they do fragment like quicksilver. But at the same time, I think one should remember that they can coalesce as quickly if they feel that their racial pride is being damaged in some way, especially by a foreign power. And I think that if Al-Qaeda were so foolish as to go there, and I presume there would be a handsome ransom involved, I don't think it would take more than 48 hours for those who wish to take the ransom and reveal the whereabouts of these people. In many ways, I think it would be a good idea if they went there, because it wouldn't last very long.
All right, Connection listeners, let's review. We have with us on the program today Scott Peterson, Christian Science Monitor journalist, former correspondent based in Africa, author of Me Against My Brother, Mark Bowden, journalist and author of Black Hawk Down, John Drysdale, author of a number of books on Somalia, including Stoics Without Pillows, and he's speaking to us from Somaliland. And when we come back, we'll talk also with Abdissalam Issa Salwe, who's author of a number of books. He'll be talking to us from London. And we would like you in the conversation. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. As the United States continues to consider Somalia as a potential target in its war on terror, what are the implications for people in that country and for this country? My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about Somalia as a country that is perhaps in the sights. Well, it is in the sights. The deputy Minister of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, has said Somalia is number one on his particular hit list of places to look at as possible targets. And why? Because it's a principally Islamic country, because in 1974, the dictator Siad Barre made friends with the Soviets and a bunch of Russian arms went in. 4 years later, he made friends with the Americans and a bunch of American arms went in. It may be a country with more weapons in it than any other on Earth. There is no government, no central government, as we heard earlier in the program. So there's little wonder why the Americans are looking at it. But what, in fact, are they looking at? My guests are Scott Peterson, author of Me Against My Brother, Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, John Drysdale, author of the book called Stoics Without Pillows, speaking to us from Somaliland. And John, I wanted to just come back to you on one point. You were talking about the fact that bin Laden wouldn't last 48 hours if he were to go to Somalia. But isn't it that the Americans and others are looking at the Al-Ittihad, Al-Islami people as possible terrorists and other people who might mobilize in the future?
Well, I don't think that they have the capacity to do any terrorist damage, maybe within their own environment they have, if they want to, and there's very little evidence of that. I think this may be a false trail.
Abdusalam Isisawe is an author of a book called The Collapse of the Somali State. He's joining us on the line from London. Mr. Sisawe, is the U.S. misguided in its consideration of Somalia as a terrorist state?
I think yes. I mean, because they have to be very cautious about Somalia now, because if they reach a quick and hastily judgment, there will be another problem. But at the same time, Americans, they have right to, I think, fair. They have to be very careful about fleeing Taliban or Al Qaeda fighters to Somalia. Because Somalia doesn't have a central authority for more than 12 years, I think there's a reason for USA to think that they may flee to Somalia. At the same time, now they have already started, to guard off the of the Somali Sea and airspace to avoid this. And because there's a proxy war called the proxy war policy, which the U.S. Using to ask the states to take care of, to look to the terrorists. But because there is no central authority, there is nobody who can take this step in Somalia.
And Scott Peterson, that's got to be one of the reasons why some of these terrorists from abroad ought to or might be concerned about going to Somalia, because if they found themselves in the territory of one clan, they're thought to be, you can correct me on this, very vulnerable to being ratted out by some other clan.
Well, this is exactly right, I think, in the sense that safe haven really is a wrong term to use when we're talking about Somalia for any of these al-Qaeda people, because they are not Somalis. Many Somalis will tell you that xenophobia is a characteristic. It's also one that we have witnessed in Afghanistan. And you'll know, of course, that many Afghans were against the al-Qaeda and Arab presence in their country. In their country as well. I mean, basically, the Taliban had been bought off by Al Qaeda and by bin Laden because they had that kind of money. But in Somalia, you have this added and much, much more complex clan system, which is the same thing in the end that defeated the United States when it was in Somalia and waging war and would likely defeat Al Qaeda people as well if they didn't play their cards right and have to work very hard to do that.
John Drysdale, just a last question to you, if you can help me with your perspective on this. Is it an appropriate time for the United States to take a very hands-off policy towards Somalia if, in fact, as some people are saying, there are the seeds of recovery taking root in that country?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's very evident that there are seeds of recovery going on in the Mogadishu environment. I think it does exist in other areas, and especially in Somaliland, but not in Mogadishu.
Mr. Drysdale, thanks for joining us. John Drysdale is author of a number of books on Somalia, including his most recent, Stoics Without Pillows. Now, our number is 1-800-423-8255 for you to join the conversation. First to Raleigh, North Carolina, Francis is on the line. Hi, Francis.
Yes, sir. Good morning. My commendations, I believe it was Mr. Drysdale, was the one that mentioned simply going in there with a bribe. I think that is an excellent idea in every respect. But my question to all of your gentlemen is, looking back at the initial exercise of going into Somalia and breaking up the stranglehold that the warlords had on the food supply, what, with regard to our overall foreign policy, was our true mission? In other words, the difference between essentially letting them rot and doing nothing and fight it out among themselves and go in there and try and civilize and organize a country that has no interest whatsoever in our intervention. A couple of the fellows that...
Are you saying, Francis, can it be done now? Is that your question?
Well, yes, sir. I personally don't believe that it can be done, can ever be done, and I question whether it should be attempted at all, other than eradicating the terrorist element that may have sought refuge there. Why is it, what is the point in any regard, what could the possible benefit be by wasting the lives of our men and our precious tax dollars on a losing cause to begin with? I cannot see any...
You sound like you have some kind of personal connection.
Well, I do in some regard. We do a lot of competitive shooting here in North Carolina. All the guys that come up from the fort in Special Forces and Delta Force shoot with us, and some of them were mentioned in that book, and a couple of them didn't come back. And I think their lives were wasted. I think their lives were wasted on people who couldn't care less. We're in there trying to separate family squabbles. You can't turn your back for one second. I worked in the Middle East myself. Had a fair amount of difficulty with in Somalia and with Somalis in general. Their attitude towards how shall we say, a gentleman's rules of conduct or even civilized rules of conduct is about two or three generations behind the rest of us.
Let's listen to Mark on this, Francis. I mean, Mark, you've had a lot of time to reflect on what the American genuine intentions were, how they were perceived by the Somalis. Talk with to Francis about his thoughts here.
Well, I think that it does make it's probably the easiest course for the United States to follow is to stay out of places where we don't have a direct national interest and where our strategic concerns aren't involved. And Somalia certainly qualifies for that. But by the same token, in this modern world, when we see images of starving babies and read stories that hundreds of thousands of people are starving to death, it becomes rather difficult to ignore the kind of moral imperative to try and do something. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that the U.S. intervention in Somalia, which began in 1992, was initially very successful. It ended a famine. It saved, I think, without question, hundreds of thousands of lives. And it really only got into trouble when it began these efforts to create a coalition government and, in effect, took sides in a civil war. And I've written, and I do think that certainly in retrospect it's easy to say, but it would have been a good idea to not have done that. I mean, to have backed out once we had made a reasonable effort to get some kind of cooperation going there. And when it was apparent that it wasn't going to succeed, I do think that there are real limits to what we can accomplish.
Francis, I wanted you to just hang on half a second, and we'll listen to Abdusalami Sisawe speak to the point that you've raised about the waste of lives in that type of encounter.
And I believe it was actually pity, and I mean the Americans who came to Somalia as a humanitarian mission who died there. Actually, we were very, very sorry, extremely sorry. At the same time, we have to be very careful about this problem because when USA and UN went to Somalia, actually, didn't have a lot of information about Somalia. And on my in my book, Collapse of Somali State, I mentioned one point when the former American ambassador, Oakley, went. He preceded the American troops to Mogadishu. And he went to meet with General Aidid, who was one of the warlords and responsible for the Somali problems. And he met with him, and by meeting with such people like Aidid, what he did was actually he interpreted as a legitimization of his control on Somalia. That was a very big mistake, because when...
He gave Aidid legitimacy, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that was interpretation for Aidid, that meeting with Oakley, he interpreted as a legitimacy to his rule.
Let's go back to Francis, if we can, because, Francis, I'm just your thoughts about whether or not, you know, the U.S. learned the sort of lesson that Abdussalam is talking about and could make this sort of intervention in an intelligent way.
Well, sir, I think the exemplary performance of our armed forces in Afghanistan is testimony to the fact that we have learned a great deal. But let me give one more, just another approach to the problem. Kenya, and this is going back some 15 years, had one of the best and most effective light infantry organizations in Africa and in Africa. And someone correct me, because I'm sure I'm wrong, but there are over 58 sovereign nations. Kenya shares a border with Somalia. Why weren't there Kenyan troops in there who share so many common cultural facts and elements, whose language, who I'm sure that there's intermarriage. I'm sure that that people vacation, that they travel back and forth. These are in neighboring states. Why was the Kenyan army not in there to quell this civil dispute? And if not that, a coalition of neighboring states.
Right. Well,
why is it always the United States that has to pack up their gear in a 141 and haul over that all around the world and come out? Anyway, I've said all I want to say.
No, but I mean, those coalition of African states do, in fact, try to keep the peace in certain countries in West Africa. But, Scott, what about the situation in Somalia?
Well, I think actually the situation in Somalia is almost a greater risk to countries like the United States and others if, in fact, they were to be, if they were, in fact, able to yield the kind of terrorism that we've seen emerge from Afghanistan. Because one of the things, just in listening to the last few moments of conversation, one of the things that has struck me is how one of the things that we haven't learned about Somalia, although it seems at the moment we are beginning to become cognizant of, is something that we learned from Afghanistan. Finally, 10 years after the Soviets left, more than a decade, we've realized that the fact that we neglected Afghanistan, were not paying attention to Afghanistan as the civil war raged, as Mujahideen groups fought against each other, as you had the Taliban takeover, as basically Afghanistan became a very serious haven for terrorism, all of that was a function of the fact that Afghanistan had been neglected by the West and by most countries for the last decade. Now, if we also officially have actually allowed Somalia to become the first ever official failed state, the United Nations walked away, the U.S. walked away, albeit under circumstances that were such that everyone wanted to wash their hands of it. I mean, at the end, the bloodshed was so great, both of in terms of UN and U.S. casualties and the Somalis themselves, that basically everybody wanted to be finished with how things were going there. But in the end, I think we tried a fine line in the sense that, you know, we now recognize after Afghanistan the risks of what Somalia could become if we don't do something about it. And the Kenyans, you know, the Kenyans and some of the other nations, I mean, they've also had their own tribal and other wars with the Somalis for centuries, and they're different ethnic groups, and I don't imagine the Kenyans are anticipating any kind of a Somali attack on their nation, and therefore, except for lawlessness up on that northern border, probably they can leave it at that, whereas the United States does have to worry. Will al-Qaeda or bin Laden or these organizations go to Somalia and make it their home? And that is an international concern.
Francis, thank you for your call.
Yes, sir.
1-800-423-8255 to Jacksonville, North Carolina. Matt, you're on The Connection. Hi, Matt. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I must say I have to agree with most of what Francis said, and most of what Mr. Bowden said. The original reason why I call is when you brought the point up about Somalia is that I think that if there are terrorists there, the Al Qaeda, I'm not sure if they're there. I don't know all the technical aspects of whether or not there are terrorists there or not. But if there are, we shouldn't let something that happened that wasn't really orchestrated properly.
If there are terrorists there of any kind.
Correct. I mean, I don't think that we should separate, you know, Afghanistan from Somalia in whether or not we should go into one or the other simply because of something that happened in 93. I mean, you know, if anything, well, yeah, I mean, just basically, we shouldn't distinguish between the two just because of something that wasn't really orchestrated correctly from the top back in 93.
Abdusalam Issa-Sahwe, is that the right approach to say, look, we messed up in 93, but we could do a proper job of helping the country now?
Yes, I think so. This is actually the best approach for actual Somalia now, because one of the resolutions of Security Council on September 28 was that 1373, that it has to be elaborated as a state level requirement in compact against global defense. I mean, this means that like global village, and Somalia is part of the world, global. And its problem, if we just keep it on, it may spread everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, we have to think up as globally. Now, I think it is a good idea also to help sort out this problem with Somalis. And as a global defense, yes, I think it will be a good approach to start something, and because whatever happens in many, many thousand miles, it may affect every nation in all over the world, as terrorism now is a threat against the world. But I personally don't believe that there is terrorism in Somalia, or because I agree with John Drysdale, his comment about actually he knows well about Somalia, and this is because just because it's a failed state, things may think that it may harbor these terrorists there. I think yes, it's a good approach that the world should go there and approach as it is.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for joining us. That's Abdusalam Issa-Sahwe. Thanks also to Matt from Jacksonville for your call. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The American movie theaters are filled with the movie Black Hawk Down. A lot of people are talking about that time in Somalia. What about this time in Somalia? Is it an appropriate time? Should the Americans be looking at that country as a target in its war on terror? My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about Somalia. Certainly American leaders are talking about Somalia as a potential next target in their war on terror. I have two guests with me at this point. Scott Peterson is a Christian Science Monitor journalist, author of Me Against My Brother at War in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda. Mark Bowden is a journalist and author of Black Hawk Down, also was involved in writing the screenplay for Black Hawk Down, which I'm informed I may have been a little hasty in saying the theaters were filled. Mark would hope that the theaters are filled when the film goes into full release a little later on. But Mark, it brings me to a question that I've been wondering about as I've listened to our callers and to you folks talk, and that is, you spoke to a lot of military people in the months, in the years after 1993. I think you're still one of their favorites on the lecture circuit in terms of helping the military see themselves. And to what extent do you see the consideration of Somalia as a target as, in a way, something of an exorcism for the demons of 1993?
I think that there is some of that there. I talked to a Marine general a couple of weeks ago about Somalia, and he said that, well, if we go in there, we're not going to be asking anybody's permission. And I think that there was an undercurrent to that, which was, we aren't particularly interested anymore, certainly speaking as a military man, in the kind of political goals that the United States had when it was involved in Somalia in 1993, that if we go in now, it will be to accomplish very, specific military goals, cognizant of the fact that there's no government really to speak of in Somalia, and there's certainly no military force capable of countering what the United States brings to bear. But I would expect that such raids would be very narrowly targeted at potential, terrorist cells or terror camps. And frankly, I think at this point, it's unlikely that it would happen.
Scott Peterson, you have spent much of the last 3 months reporting from Afghanistan, and you will know from your work with the Christian Science Monitor how much we know about Uzbekistan, about Tajiks and the Hindu Kush, the Pashtuns. In many ways, the way that the war on terror has been conducted thus far in Afghanistan has taught Americans a great deal about that country. And back in 1993, nobody knew anything about Somalia, in part the military as well. So what do Americans need to know about Somalia if, in fact, that country or others in East Africa are to become part of the next targets in the war on terror?
Well, I think that Americans shouldn't be still concentrating so much on what happened in 1993, because I think as one of the callers pointed out, I mean, this really was a mission that it wasn't doomed from the start, because truly it did start on a very good note. And for several weeks, even for the first couple of months, it was a very positive mission. The humanitarian work was getting done. Lives were being saved. Food was getting to people. The problem was that Somalis had expectations of even more. There were two things I think that Somalis expected, and what they told me very much they expected in those days. And those are the kind of things that if they had occurred, I think, may have changed the history book, so that we may now, instead of been talking about Somalia as a complete disaster, we may have been saying, wait a minute, that was the first humanitarian intervention that actually worked. And the two things are, one is that Somalis expected the United States to disarm everybody in Somalia. As you mentioned before, this is one of the most well-armed countries in the world. And that's not to say that Somalis are happy or easily convinced to give up their weapons. But the bottom line is that in those days when the United States first arrived in Somalia, there was a moment of kind of national disorientation. Somalis were very tired of the civil war. They were very tired of the warlords that had been ruling and ruining their lives for the past couple of years, that had causing so much bloodshed. And they would have, I think, and many Somalis tell me, accepted disarmament. In fact, I saw Americans do some partial disarmament, and it was welcomed by people who were there in the early stages of this operation. The second thing, the main mistake, I think, which really caused problems throughout the operation was as the Somali author described, was giving legitimacy to the warlords who were on the ground. And partly that was a decision made literally on the eve before the Marines first touched down on that beach in Mogadishu in December 1992. And part of it was because they wanted to guarantee a safe landing. But what it meant for the warlords is that it kept them in play. It kept them as political players. And it meant that the U.S. and the U.N. then had to deal with them later. And it very much complicated efforts afterwards. But now, I mean, if we looking at the situation in Somalia now and today, I think it's right that probably the al-Qaeda activity is small for all the reasons that we've described already. And if we do see operations, it's not going to be anything like the kind of war against terrorism that we've seen in Afghanistan, where we had the Northern Alliance a worthwhile, if you will, proxy to arm and to back. And in Somalia, I think it's going to be much more piecemeal. And really, enemies and friends are just to draw lines between them is going to be extremely difficult.
1-800-423-8255 to Mary, calling us from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Dick. I would like the authors to address the role of Somalia and the role of the United States, how it is flip-flopped in their support between Ethiopia and Somalia. And I know it's a very broad kind of reaching question right there, but to address our role in Somalia, I believe you would have to address our entire role, and it might be political, in the Horn of Africa and how that serves our country.
Scott, that sounds like one for you.
Yeah, I think that's I think that is very worthwhile, and we do need to address that, because I think one of the options that was initially put forward for a U.S. Operation in the Horn of Africa, and specifically in Somalia, was to back some of the same groups that Ethiopia backed. And I think one of the reasons for that is because that might be the path of least resistance, as seen by Pentagon planners. And the reason is because there have been various pockets of Islamists and other radical Islamic groups in Somalia. They've taken root in the course of the anarchy. They're also in many ways homegrown. They've been there since the late 80s, but they really did take on a much more radical bent in recent years, so much so that the Ethiopian military in 1996 started crossing the border in certain areas to try and oust these people. So that's, you know, they made several cross-border incursions. They're currently apparently gearing up for more. But that said, if the United States backs these groups, the Ethiopians also for decades have had a conflict with Somalis. They have fought wars before in the time of Siad Barre. There's all kinds of background baggage that the U.S. at least needs to be aware of when it makes decisions about which horse to back. And maybe it's just a question of making it clear what kind of a temporary horse you're going to back. Because in the Horn, you're right to point out, looking at the greater strategic flip-flops. I mean, it wasn't, in just the last 20 years that at one point we saw the U.S. backing Somalia very much against the Soviet-backed Ethiopians, and also vice versa. That was one of the most significant flip-flops of the Cold War happened there in the Horn of Africa.
Mary, thanks for your call. I think it's a good point that you have to be very careful about compartmentalizing who you make friends with and looking too narrowly. To Boston now. Abdul is on the line. Hi, Abdul.
Hi, Mr. Gordon.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I have a comment and then I have a brief question. The comment, I think we are doing the same mistakes in Somalia as we did in 1992. When we talk about Somalia, I think the media and politicians in America and Western Europe and even the Arab world neglect what's happening in Somaliland.
Somaliland, we should point out, is a sort of quasi-independent northern part of Somalia. Am I right with that, Abdul?
Yes. They were part of Somalia, and then they seceded because of what happened in Somalia. And actually, there was some misinformation about the civil war. The civil war started in northern Somalia in 1988.
Okay, but let's bring it to the point now. What's working there that's not working in Somalia?
It's working. They disarmed more than 50,000 of armed Somalis. Since 1991, they form a government. They actually passed a constitution. There was a referendum this year, and it's going to be a presidential election this coming few months. With no help from nobody, they did with their own people, without asking the United Nations or anybody to come to, with their own terms. They call all the elders, different clans together to form a government, and that's working. And the UN is not actually recognizing that.
Abdul seems to be talking about the one thing that Mark Bowden keeps coming up in your book, that every time you turn a page, every time you turn a corner, you're seeing a man or a woman carrying an AK. Get the guns out of the hands of the people.
Well, I sure agree with Scott that would have been a logical step in trying to create a coalition government there. When I was in Mogadishu in 1997, I was moved by the vast majority of people who are sort of imprisoned in this anarchical condition. The intellectuals especially have no place to work. The most Westerners have of Somalia is of, you know, these armed gunmen ready to go after one another, and those people are definitely there. But I think that they are just a well-armed, aggressive, violent minority, and most people are trapped in this situation. And it's a difficult task, and frankly, I don't see the United States, for better or for worse, taking on any political goals in Somalia in the near future. I think if there are terrorist cells there, or if bin Laden or any of his people were so unwise as to seek haven there because it's a kind of a lawless zone, probably American troops would go after them directly, target them specifically, and get in and get out. That would be the intention anyway. So all of this talk about the United States getting involved in a sort of broader political effort to try to solve Somalia's problems is, I think, pretty theoretical and very unlikely.
Scott and Mark, Abdul, thanks for your call. But Scott and Mark, I want to both hear you both speak about one aspect of your work and your understanding of that country, because it seems in many ways that what went wrong in 93, we've covered this in the program, was the lack of understanding or appreciation of the people on the ground, that they are people who, you know, who have to eat, who have to get their hair cut, who have to, you know, find petrol for a car if they have a car, that sort of thing. Is a large part of the exercise simply working a little harder to understand the people in a country like Somalia, in a city like Mogadishu? Scott, do you want to start?
Well, I think that the United States, I mean, we had people who were in those operations in 1992 and 1993 who had a lot of experience with Somalia. And in fact, John Drysdale, who you just had on, was in fact one of the main advisors for the UN, although I think a somewhat reluctant one. He was actually the liaison between the UN and General Idid during the actual manhunt.
They didn't take his advice, though, did they?
Well, no, that's exactly right. And the point being that even though there were people who knew full well about Somalis and who had the understanding that we're talking about and that we so often yearn for, the people who were making the decisions, whether they were Admiral Jonathan Howe, who one Pentagon official described as the miscasting of the century, for example, you know, and other senior military figures, did not have that kind of grasp, went with their instinct, and many times it was wrong, because I just don't think that U.S. senior U.S. military officials were even remotely concerned that they might be possibly defeated by people who were wearing flip-flops and just didn't appear to be any kind of a military force that we could be defeated by. So that was the kind of mistake that we made then. And in order to do it right this time, I think Mark's correct in that what we would see would be something that would be very targeted. It would be very limited. Although I was very curious to hear what the United Nations had to say just in the last few days. They came out and said that basically they think that any military operation against Somalia was going to be a mistake because the fragile situation there was so tenuous. That there could be, you know, that it really could bump what was supposed, so they say, a budding regeneration and a budding peace over the last few years coming together. But more importantly, was they said what really Somalia needs is aid, help, something that would give them hope so that they aren't going to be the kind of haven that we've seen in Afghanistan.
And Mark Bowden, again, an understanding that they are people there, both in the book and in the film. It's something you have to keep in your mind.
I think definitely. First, I'd actually like to say before I leave the program how much I admire and respect the work that Scott Peterson has done in the last decade or so covering Africa. He's done an amazing job.
I second that.
I think that, unfortunately, the foreign policy of the United States is not that focused on the welfare of countries like Somalia, and we've paid a heavy price for that. I think that in the long run, we do have to be better educated, be better informed, invest in these countries in things like schools and infrastructure, do things like, if possible, offer inducements to disarm factions, try to support this fledgling government, which now exists more in theory than in reality, because that's the only way that we're going to make any headway in sort of clearing that region of these extremist cells who are obviously such a threat to us.
Thanks to both of you, Mark Bowden, journalist and author of Black Hawk Down, Scott Peterson, Christian Science Monitor correspondent earlier from Abdul Salami Sasawe and John Drysdale, both as part of the program. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR.